श्रीला गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरिनाम संकीर्तन की जय, श्री श्री गौर नित्यानंद की जय, गौर भक्त वृंद की जय, गौर प्रिमान हरि हरि वो। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल, गुड इवनिंग एंड थैंक्स सो मच फॉर योर प्रेजेंस हियर, दोस कनेक्टेड ऑनलाइन एज वेल। And as Dev Madhav Prabhu mentioned in the introduction today, he selected this day for me speaking a little bit about giving some introduction to one book I recently published. I have it here because I'll share something about that from that. So this inherent or inherited Bhakti in the Jiva according to Gaudiya Vedanta. Where I mostly dealt with the topic of whether bhakti is part of the Atma's inherent constitution or it is something that is being received, given as a gift, received by grace, divine grace. So, and how to accommodate, how to understand, how to deal with apparent differences of opinion in our particular lineage. So what I'm trying to present in this book is, of course, my view on the topic, but trying, of course, not to make it just what I think independently, but trying to share what Shastra is saying in that regard, and trying to present the quotes from our main scriptures in a, hopefully in a sensitive way, in proper context, and from there trying to make a case for whatever conclusion I'm sharing there, basically. So, for those who may already be a little bit familiar with the content of my book, whether by reading it or hearing some of the previous lectures I gave, and especially for those who don't, the book begins with a brief, and this is what Dev Madhav Prabhu mentioned, and I will try to focus today a little bit more on that, this notion of epistemic hierarchy, which basically means if we are about to speak about any topic in our particular Gaudiya Sampradaya, how to reach a particular conclusion in a particular topic, a particular siddhanta or perfected conclusion, there is, if you will, a hierarchy to consider regarding which will be our main pramana or our main source of evidence. So it's important that first of all we establish that clearly so we can engage in some fruitful dialogue and not just like saying, well, I think this, or I hear that, I read that, and but just trying to have a particular order in which to give a specific weight to our Gaudiya revelation. And of course, for us Gaudiyas, and that's the point I'm trying to make in the first chapter of the book, our topmost praman, or our topmost source of spiritual scriptural evidence is Srimad Bhagavatam. Srila Jiva Goswami wrote a whole book making that point called Tattva Sandarbha, interestingly. It's a whole book showing how Srimad Bhagavatam for us Gaudiyas is what we may call Pramana Shiromani, or the crest jewel of all scriptural evidence. And by extension, we also consider the books, the immediate books of the Goswamis, as a natural extension of what is in the Bhagavatam. Because if you study the books of the Goswamis, Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, Sandarbhas, Brihad Bhagavatamrita, and his commentaries on the Bhagavatam, you will realize all their books revolve around the Bhagavatam. Actually, all their books are a detailed explanation of what is in the Bhagavatam. One thing is to go to the Bhagavatam by ourselves, another thing is to explore the Bhagavatam taking the hands of the Goswamis. I can assure you that you will find much more that we can, what you can discover independently, if you will. So, in that connection, establishing that both Srimad Bhagavatam and Goswami Granta, the books of the Goswamis, constitute our main scriptural source of evidence, I try to present how they, in a very clear and consensual way, show that bhakti is not inherent in the constitution of the jiva, but actually is a gift that we receive, and we as Tathasta Shakti have the potential for that. I won't make a detailed case today about all that I wrote in hundreds of pages there in that regard, but in very brief words, bhakti is described in Shastra as the essence of the Swarup Shakti. And Swarup Shakti is described as one of three main Shaktis of Bhagavan: Maya Shakti, Tatastha Shakti, and Swarup Shakti. And clearly in Shastra is mentioned that Swarup Shakti is not present in the constitution of the Jiva. So if bhakti is the essence of Swarup Shakti, and Swarup Shakti is not in the Jiva, then bhakti is not in the Jiva. But we have the potential to embrace, to integrate Swarup Shakti into our lives to the point of almost, if you will, becoming almost one with bhakti in the form that an iron bar can be put into fire and acquire all the qualities of fire. So we have that potential, if you want to put it in that word, or as I today I quoted something from Srila Siddhar Maharaj, he will speak in terms of adaptability. So tatastha, the very term tatastha, what we are, has to do with adaptability. And the best form of adaptability will be exercised in relation to Swarup Shakti. So basically that's the general premise of the first part of the book, which I try to show what Shastra says about this particular topic. But of course, the question may come, well, but I've heard here and there that some other acharyas, maybe more contemporary ones, may have said something different, apparently different at least. So that's why I wrote the second part of my book, because the book has two parts. The first one shows what Shastra says, and the second part tries to harmonize or explain or understand why at times some of our contemporary acharyas may have said something to the contrary. I could have stopped my book on the first part and saved myself from lots of controversy. But to be honest, I felt, I'm almost sure that every single person who will write the book will then say, but what about this and, and this and this that I read, that I heard? So, okay, let's do a second part. And let's have a little bit of a few headaches here and there. No problem. So today I'd like to concentrate a little bit on this section. We have what Shastra is saying, but also we may hear something different from some sadhus or from maybe Sri Guru, whatever the case. So my point is, we have this, how do you say in English, like triad. Like Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. I imagine all of you have heard this expression. Guru, Shastra, Sadhu. Guru, Shastra, Sadhu. So how to reconcile if one of the three seems to say something different from the other? Is there any like prominence that is to be given to one above the other, or how to put all this in context? And so today I'd like to concentrate my presentation on this topic, on Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu, and which is paramount of these three, if there is any, and how and where and so on. So today, actually this topic came some time ago, speaking with different devotees. One of them was Jai Jagannath Prabhu, who spoke quite a while on this topic, as you can imagine. So we were thinking about this point, no? Like the crux of the whole of this whole epistemological issue, at least for some, is how a practitioner is to understand and view this triad of Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. If you would like to represent this triad in a triangle, if you want to put it like that, so which one of the three is at the zenith of the triangle, in which other two occupy the two, how do you say, vertices below, as representative of the one on top, no? If you want to put it in geometrical terms for a moment. So the answer to that, of course, is not that simple and that like simplistic, if you will. It's nuanced, as life is. So we could say that in one sense, Guru is more important, the most important of all. In one sense, we could say Guru is more important than Shastra. In which sense? In the sense that the Guru, he, she, just in case, personifies, if it's he, she's bona fide, personifies the living essence in the teaching and the in the application of what we find in Shastra. So I hope you follow my point. Okay, the guru is more important than Shastra because he's like the active principle of divinity, and Shastra may be considered passive in that regard, in one sense. But all the importance that guru will have in our lives will be derived of what Shastra is saying. Because if you go to the definition of guru, you will always hear the guru is someone who teaches Shastra and behaves according to Shastra. So the way in which the guru is more important than Shastra depends on how much the guru resorts to Shastra in both teaching and behavior. So the guru's importance is derived from Shastra. So even if you want to make the case that in one sense, okay, Gurudev is more important than Shastra, if you take Shastra out of the equation, which is the relevance of Sri Guru in that case? Because again, Sabde Paricha Nishnatam, Bhagavatam is saying, who is the guru? Someone who is an expert in Shastra, in teaching it and in inhabiting the concepts, in living them. No? So maybe you're starting to see in which direction I'm going, but we see, again, the point. Guru has to behave and to speak according to Shastra. We never hear, we sometimes hear, okay, that person didn't speak about Shastra on the basis of Shastra. But we never will hear, Shastra is not speaking according to Guru. Mm-hmm. No? Because it's the other way around how it works. It's not that Shastra has to adjust and base on what a sadhu said, but someone will be sadhu or guru deriving his or her standing on what, on how much, on which degree that person is aligning himself or herself with the revealed sound. So, again, in those cases that the guru is more important than Shastra, if you take Shastra out of the equation, guru stops being more important than Shastra. Because actually, in the way he's more important than Shastra, nonetheless has to do with Shastra. So even in that way that the guru is more important, we could say Shastra is in the background, sustaining that. So in that sense, Shastra is more important, if you put it like that. We could say the guru is more important than Shastra in the sense that the guru personifies, Sri Guru is the personification of a type of love, of a type of bhakti, which comes as a result of a type of practice which is delineated in Shastra. Because we may say, okay, Gurudev is more, very important because he embodies love for God. But that love comes out of a practice, and that practice is revealed in Shastra and is executed on the basis of Shastra. So however we may like to put it, generally it all boils down to Shastra as the foundation. If we take that, we have no foundation, basically. So I will argue, and again, as you will see, it's not just my own opinion, that Shastra is the most important of all. Especially when it comes to what we are speaking today, which is establishing some doctrinal matters, some siddhantic topics, conclusions in our school. So regarding ascertaining ultimate conclusions in our sampradaya, the guru is a representative of what has originally been established in Shastra. I'd like to share with you one quote from Srila Prabhupada. This comes from a purport to Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Matya Lila, chapter 20, verse 352. Again, for Ananda Murari, 220, 352. You'd let me know if this is clear or not. He says like this. He's speaking about Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu here. One should accept a thing as genuine by studying the words of saintly people, the spiritual master, and the Shastra, Guru, Shastra, Sadhu. The actual center is the Shastra, the revealed scripture. If a spiritual master does not speak according to the revealed scripture, he is not to be accepted. Similarly, if a saintly person does not speak according to Shastra, he is not a saintly person. The Shastra is the center for all. Unfortunately, at the present moment, people do not refer to the Shastras. That's how Prabhupada concludes that section. So I think it's pretty clear. He's invoking this principle of Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu, and he's mentioning if a Guru does not refer to Shastra, basically, it's not Guru. If a Sadhu does not refer to Shastra, he's not saying if a Shastra does not refer to Sadhu or to Guru, but the referring has to be in that connection. And he will say between these three, between this triangle, if you wanted to put it like that, he says Shastra is the center for all. So since we had invoked this idea of Shastra, also I'd like to share a few words concerning the idea of Shastriya Shraddha that you may have heard. It is spoken of by our Goswamis. Shastriya Shraddha means basically, Shraddha means faith, in simple words, and Shastriya means in connection to Shraddha. So Shastriya Shraddha means faith, that is faith in Shastra, basically. For us in Bhakti, it is mentioned that the adhikar to begin Bhakti, to engage in Bhakti, is Shraddha. Now, if you have Shraddha, welcome to the club, if you will. You can practice Bhakti. And our Shraddha, ideally, is Shastriya Shraddha. In other words, faith in the import of what Shastra is saying. Because we have faith in something, in someone. So in Bhakti, faith is in revelation, in what's coming from Shastra. In contrast to this type of Shraddha, called Shastriya Shraddha, our Goswami speak about Laukiki Shraddha. Laukiki Shraddha. Which means basically a type of faith that has been acquired mainly, merely by, how do you put it in English, like social convention. That's called Loka Parampara. Social convention. Maybe, I don't know, my ancestors were worshipping whatever deity, Deva, and I continue doing the worship because it was coming from my family ancestors, but I don't have very clear understanding why this is to be done and what's the purpose and who is that person in the altar or whatever. But my father did, my grandfather did, so I continue out of, again, social convention. That happens a lot. But that's not Shastriya Shraddha. No. Laukiki Shraddha, which is a way, again, of saying faith which is not based on Shastra, basically. It's not a faith that is developed through ascertaining the import of the scriptures. That's Shastriya Shraddha. So, interestingly, this is one of the symptoms of a Kanishtha Adhikari, the Shastra says. Kanishtha Adhikari is not someone who has deeply rooted Shastriya Shraddha, but his her faith will be more out of social convention or out of some form of, if you will, on some level at least, sentimentalism or something. Not condemning that person. Someone is Kanishtha Adhikari, is glorious, is already on the path of Bhakti, but that faith has to be, if you will, nourished and polished and educated in regarding to revelation. So Srila Jiva Goswami is basically saying that the faith of a Kanishtha Adhikari is not the outcome of assimilating Shastra. When you understand the meaning of scripture, your faith will be Shastriya Shraddha. Will depend on what this revelation is saying. So basically for us as Gaudiyas, ideally faith means faith in what Shastra is saying, in the meanings of the words of the scriptures. So that's an important point. Interestingly, I received some comments, not that many, but some, from a few people who were considering that some sections of my book were disturbing the faith of others. So, of course, I spoke with them and other devotees, and of course, to begin with, that's not my intention, and that has not been my experience while writing the book, to begin with, and that has not been the experience of many others who read the book. But, of course, we can never satisfy everyone on the same level, basically. But the point was, I say, well, look, what I'm trying to do in my book is not so much to say what I think, but to show what Shastra is saying on this topic. So if by my quoting Shastra your faith is disturbed, what type of faith do you have? Because ideally, your faith is to be nourished by Shastra. But if I quote Shastra and you are disturbed, then maybe the problem is not with my quoting Shastra, but with your faith that does not want to hear Shastra or something. It's disturbed by Shastra. You follow my point? So we are to develop Shastriya Shraddha. Ideally, we should be able to hear Shastra, to understand Shastra, and to nourish our faith through Shastra, not to be disturbed by it. Again, not condemning anyone, but just analyzing how sometimes these dynamics may play out. So at this point, of course, we are speaking about Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. And someone may say, well, if Shastra is more important, well, but everything that my Guru says is Shastra. I've heard that sometimes. Everything, Guru is a Sadhu, and what he says is Shastra. But my point is, so why this separate category that we hear over and over again, Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu, oh, Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu, is repeatedly over and over. It means there is a difference between those three. Because if the three are the same, why explain them separately over and over again? So, for us, Shastra is not whatever every sadhu or guru is saying. No? Whatever a sadhu says, that falls in the category of sadhu. Whatever Sri Guru is saying, falls in the category of guru. Which ideally is something said on the basis of Shastra. But the point is, there is something separate called Shastra, which is not necessarily anything that says had been said by some people. So again, for us, Gaudiya Vaishnavas, Shastra means, as you mentioned today, Srimad Bhagavatam and the books of the Goswamis to begin with. That's the foundational scriptural basis of our Gaudiya Sampradaya, as we know. And that's why I began my book speaking about this idea of epistemic hierarchy, because if we don't have clear what's Shastra for us, then the conversation on these and other topics may go nowhere. Because someone may say, well, but that sadhu says something, this thing once in a morning walk 300 years ago, and this other, my guru say this, and I can say, my guru say this, and we can be forever just saying, my guru say this, and you say, my guru say this, and my guru. So we need to go to some place where the two of us find full consensus. So that's to go to those shastras that are unanimously accepted in all the Gaudiya Sampradaya. Like I was speaking with one devotee about this topic, and the devotee was saying, okay, Bhaktivinoda Thakur say this, okay, but, and I'm trying to address it in my book, but I said, if you are speaking with some Gaudiya who doesn't come from the lineage of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you cannot say, my Bhaktivinoda Thakur say this, because for them, Bhaktivinoda Thakur doesn't hold the same weight than for us. And there's place for that also. So, if I speak with people from other sampradayas, so then we have to go to those, again, common consensual scriptures that all Gaudiyas accept as foundational. And again, the books of the Goswamis hold equal weight, I would say, than the Srimad Bhagavatam, and in one sense even more, in the sense that they're expanding the meaning of the Bhagavatam. The Goswamis were especially, as you know, especially empowered. The Goswamis were especially empowered by Mahaprabhu, were especially instructed to write what we call the Bhakti Shastras. They are called our Shastra Gurus in our Sampradaya. Because they have this specific function that Mahaprabhu gave to them right at the beginning of the Sampradaya to be the architects of the Sampradaya. My Guru Maharaj likes to give this example. Mahaprabhu was like a very powerful, ecstatic, as it has been described, like a golden volcano of divine love. So it's a little bit intimidating to approach a volcano, especially if it's erupting. No, it's like, okay, we can take a picture some kilometers from distance, but not get closer. Sometimes he's compared like to a waterfall. Similarly intimidating, get closer to a waterfall. So my Guru Maharaj will say, okay, Mahaprabhu was like a waterfall, and the Goswamis took that waterfall of his ecstasy, and they make a lake with the writing, so we can approach to that lake, peaceful lake, and bathe immersed there, because the waterfall may be too intimidating. So that lake are the books of the Goswamis. which speak all what was Mahaprabhu about in his inner self. So the Goswami's books are considered Shastra. They are not considered something written by a sadhu. Of course, the Goswamis are sadhus, but in our Gaudiya epistemology, this has been established by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his Raghavarma Chandrika and other places. Goswamis are our Shastra gurus. And especially, I will say, in this connection of the books of the Goswamis, the Satsandarbhas of Srila Jiva Goswami hold a very interesting position, because Srila Jiva Goswami has been empowered by Mahaprabhu to be the Tattvacharya of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. Different Goswamis represent different functions. As you know, Rupa Goswami was empowered to write about Avideya or Rasa, so he's called Rasa Acharya, Avideya Acharya. Govinda Dev, the deity he installed, represents Avideya. Sanatana Goswami, empowered to establish Sambandha Gyan. Vaishnava etiquette, also Maryad. Then Raghunath Das Goswami, empowered to establish Prayojan. He's uniquely absorbed in the principle of Radha Dasyam, which is the highest reach of our Sampradaya. Gopal Bhatta Goswami, he was empowered to be the Diksha Guru among the Goswamis, interestingly. Mahaprabhu gave to him his asana, his kopin, which symbolizes you are the acharya. And interestingly, the consideration for Gopal Bhatta being the acharya, of course he was totally qualified, but also he had a very prestigious birth. He was born in South India, he was a Brahmin, he was the son of the head priest of the Rangaji temple. So it's a relative consideration, but which held some weight in the climate and the times at that moment. And what about Raghunath Bhatta Goswami? He was very especially famous for cooking, so that's also important. How much someone has to cook. Archan, and also he will chant the Bhagavatam very sweetly in four different melodies. So do not downplay cooking, please. And say, Raghunath Bhatta was just the cook. I mean, if you don't have cook, we don't have our kitchen religion here. And Jiva Goswami, the youngest of the Goswamis, he was considered the Tattvacharya. In the words of Srila Prabhupada, the greatest philosopher of all time. So that's not small.
Comment.
Yeah, basically.
Or accomplishment.
Yeah, accomplishment, yeah. The greatest philosopher of all time. So we should have a look at what Jiva Goswami is saying, just in case. If we really want to follow Srila Prabhupada, and Prabhupada say he's the greatest philosopher of all time, I will say, okay, I think I have to go through some of what he wrote. So he clearly, Jiva Goswami, he clearly mentioned this idea of bhakti not being inherent in the jiva, especially in his sandarbhas, and most especially in his bhakti sandarbha. And in his bhakti sandarbha, for example, in connection to our topic of guru, shastra, and sadhu, he very interestingly establishes also the, if you will, the ultimacy of shastra by quoting one verse from Kurma Purana in Anucheda 265. That says, to contradict the authorized conclusions of scripture is atheism, and to do so is millions of times worse than hostility towards one's guru. Mm-hmm. Of course, with this, he's not saying, you can offend Gurudev, it's not that problematic. He's not making that point. The point is, again, the ultimacy of Shastra and how Sri Guru, to be who he is relying on Shastra. Sorry again? That's a verse from Kurma Puran, which is quoted by Jiva Goswami in Bhakti Sandarbha 265, just in case. Kurma Purana 2:16:18. So, of course, the idea here is criticism. Criticism of Shastra is considered more grievous than criticism of one's guru, because, as we said, the guru derives his or her authority from the authority of Shastra. It is Shastra that defines the qualities of a guru, basically. If you don't have Shastra, you don't have a clue what to expect from a guru. Who is guru, who is not guru? I mean, all that is being said in Shastra. Let me share with you some of the main verses from Shastra about Sri Guru. There are three main verses, I would say. I mean, there are so many, but three main, which are actually very similar to each other and appear in three different scriptures. In Mundaka Upanishad, Bhagavad Gita, and Srimad Bhagavatam. Maybe all of you mostly will know the one to begin with, at least from Bhagavad Gita 4:34. tadhini pranipatena pariprasnena sivaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnanina sattva darsinaha. So this verse basically is, all these verses, as we will see, will speak about the qualities of the guru, also the qualities of the disciple, which is a very important point also. It's not just, okay, where is the guru, how is the guru, but also where I am, where is the disciple, where I am as a disciple. Because I've heard sometimes people asking me, telling me, Maharaj, I've looked for a guru, but I'm not finding my guru. Where is my guru, where is my guru? But the point is, are you there as a disciple? Because if you are not ready to do your part, your guru may be here, but you are not finding. Because you are not where you have to be as a disciple. It's a 50-50% equation. It's not that a gurudev will do everything and I just do not have to be preoccupied about being a servant, a disciple. No, no, there is some homework to do. So this verse is saying, Tad vidhi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya. To begin with, mention these three points that we have to approach the guru with. Surrender to the guru, pranipat, which interestingly Srila Prabhupada translates as approach the guru. So that's a very interesting idea, because actually pranipat means surrender to the guru. But Prabhupada says approach the guru. Like in plain, approach the guru means surrender to the guru. It's not approach like physically and take a selfie. I'm approaching, I'm close to him. That doesn't happen. Real proximity to the guru is in terms of anugatya, or inner following, if you will, surrender. Srila Siddhar Maharaj once, he said, in the body of the guru there may be different germs and other entities which are very intimately associated with him, but actually are taking energy from the body. So you can be very close to the guru in a spirit of exploitation. So real proximity is surrender, pranipat. Pariprasna, inquire in a humble way, and sivaya, render, offer some favorable service. Upadekshanti te jnanam, jnanina tattva darshinaha. Then comes the symptoms of the guru. Jnani and tattva darshin. These two important points. Jnani means he has knowledge, and the knowledge is of Shastra. And tattva darshin means he is a seer of truth. So he doesn't only have the theoretical information, but he's also experiencing transformation. One thing is information, another thing is transformation. So the guru has both, a theoretical knowledge of Shastra, and he's walking the talk. He has inner insight. That's one verse. A second verse, which is similar from the Bhagavatam, says, Tasmat gurum prapadyata vipnyasu sriya utamam sabde parichanishnatam brahmani upasamashrayam. Basically saying the same, saying, if you want, you have to approach a guru and surrender to him, Tashman Gurum Prapadita, Jignashu Shreya Utaman. If you are inquiring about the highest good, you have to take shelter in a guru. And then says, Shabde Pare Cha Nishnatam. The guru is, Nishnatam means like, drenched. Drenched, you say? Drenched. He's drenched. He has knowledge of Shastra. He's drenched in Shabda. He's drenched in revealed sound. He has pari. He has realization of Shastra. Sometimes Shastra is, Brahman is calling the Bhagavatam Shabda Brahman, and you have then Para Brahman. So Shabda Brahman is the absolute in the form of sound, referring to Shastra. And by going to that one, then you attain Para Brahman, personal absolute. So, sabde pare chanishnatam brahmani upasamashrayam. He has control all of his senses. He has taken shelter in upasama, in tranquility. So again, this other verse is saying the guru has knowledge of Shastra and has realization of Shastra, similar to the Bhagavad Gita. And there is one more verse, which is from the Mundaka Upanishad, which says, tad vijnanartam sagurumi bhavigachet samitpani shrotriyam brahmanishtam. Again, similar idea, interestingly. Tad vijnanartam, if you are looking for the highest type of knowledge, sagurum evabhi gachet, you must approach a guru. Not like an artificial imposition, but if, like my guru likes to say, you must approach a guru. Like if you have to do that, you must approach. If you need want that, you have to do that. There's no way out. And then it says, Samitpani Shrotriyam Brahmanishtam. So one has to approach with the disposition of sacrifice, and the guru is Shrotriyam Brahmanishtam. Again, Shrotriyam means expert in Shruti, expert in the sound, revealed sound, expert in Shastram. Brahmanishtam means he's firmly situated in Brahman. Brahman in this case means not impersonal Brahman, but the Absolute. So he has firm realization of the Absolute based on Shastra. So again, these three verses, which are the most important ones about which are the attributes we are to expect in the Guru, all the three mentioned, Guru is expert in Shastra, Guru has realization on the basis of Shastra. So that on one side, and I'd like to share a few words from my book, if it's no problem. I'd like to read a few pages with your permission, in this connection, of course. To conclude my presentation, and of course, if there are questions or anything, we can continue speaking. So I'll read a few pages. This tastes like this. It's a subtitle of in the book that's called "The Ultimacy of Shastra and the Sadhu's Role in It." Pages 243 onwards. As has been explained above, the utterances of Guru and Sadhu must be backed up of or reconciled with Gaudiya Siddhanta, with Shastra. If they are not reconcilable, then a secondary explanation for their statements must be sought. Otherwise, those statements cannot be accepted as Siddhanta. In other words, we cannot allow spontaneous new ideas to appear in our Siddhanta on the plea of their being the Guru's utterance and therefore absolute, without seeking solid Shastric support for such conclusions. As Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada nicely establishes in his purport to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 17, verse 15, he says, "The process of speaking in spiritual circles is to say something upheld by the scriptures. One should at once quote from scriptural authority to back up what he's saying." End of the quote. In this connection, Narottam Das Thakur says in his Prema Bhakti Chandrika, verse 12, "Sadhu Shastra Guru Bhakya Hridaye Kariya Aikya." A similar line is somewhere else also. Or, this means, "In my heart, I will see the words of the saints, the scriptures, and the Guru as one and the same." The implied suggestion here is that there can be more than one or several apparently opposing perspectives and insights that we receive from these three foundational sources, and that considerable effort is required. Here the word Kriya means having made, presenting effort. So considerable effort is required to then digest those statements in such a way that a singularity, or the word Aikya means singularity, is reached or emerges in the heart, Hridaye. Ultimately, that singularity consists on what Shastra has originally revealed. Hence, it is highly inconsistent to accept something from anyone as the Siddhanta of our line if it has no support from the Shastra. We call this fundamentalism. The proper way to verify a philosophical conclusion is to determine its conformity to Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. And since without Shastra, we cannot even know the proper definition of the other two. Of the three, Shastra is thus supreme. Sri Krishna confirms this important point in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 16, verse 23. "Ja Shastra vidimutriya vartati kama karataha na sasidim avapnatim na sukham na parangatim." Basically, he's saying that for someone who rejects Shastra and acts whimsically, that person do not attain perfection, highest goal, nor happiness. So you may ask, what do you attain if that's the case? A big headache, maybe. So in this connection, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 2.1.25 says that one of the 64 qualities of Sri Krishna is that he himself is Shastra Chakshuhu. He sees through the eyes of scripture. Also, while elaborating on Bhagavad Gita 17.1 and 17.13, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments in his conclusion to Raghavartma Chandrika 2.8. He says, "These three groups of persons are reprehensible, one of them being those who perform sacrifices in disregard of injunctions of the scriptures. Before they disregard the scriptures, such persons have repeatedly experienced, are experiencing, and in the future will experience many disturbances. It is pointless to discuss this any further, he says. This foundational notion is further supported by a famous statement from the Brahma Yamala, abundantly quoted by both Vishwanath and Shirupa, as well as all of our main Gaudiya Acharyas. And the verse is Shruti Smriti Puranadi Pancharatra Vidimbina Akaitiki Harer Bhaktir Utpatayaiva Kalpate, which basically means that bhakti which is executed without considering the statements of Shastra, it's an unnecessary disturbance to society. So another point that makes, if you take out Shastra, disturbance is there, even in the name of bhakti. One last paragraph. We could say that Shastra is so powerful that it even rules over God. For example, although Buddha is an incarnation of Bhagavan, luminaries such as Srila Jiva Goswami have declared that his teachings are rejected by Gaudiyas because they are not supported by Shastra. Even his God. Of course, while Shastra is the last word, we must not forget that it is understood through the medium of Guru and Sadhu. Thus, the process is not as simple as it appears, but without taking instruction in a bona fide parampara, one will be lost in the jungle of sounds, as Srila Siddhartha Maharaj says sometimes, coming from the scripture. Shastra itself confirms this fact over and over again. Like Tarko, Pratishtha, Srutta Yogi, you know, many verses. Still, even if we go along with the argument that the Guru's word is final no matter what the Shastra says, then we must accept that the Guru has also his Guru, who also had a Guru. In this way, going back up to the chain of succession, ultimately one will reach Krishna, the original Guru, from whom Shastra comes, and who himself sticks to Shastra, as we mentioned. So we are back where we started, with the Shastra as the ultimate Pramana. Therefore, one has to follow Krishna, which means following his words, which are nothing but Shastra. So, so some words in this connection. And of course, sometimes, and that's what I try to deal with in my book, in some cases it seems that something that Sri Guru mentions or some sadhu mentions seems to contradict Shastra. We cannot just modify Shastra to adjust to whatever that sadhu is saying. But we should examine in detail what the Guru has said, to whom, in which circumstance, what he said before, what he said after, and see that probably there are most exceptional cases and it's hopefully not the norm. And that's what I've tried to do in the second part of the book, trying to analyze those particular cases, where, why, how, and present some possibilities as to how to harmonize those statements. For more on that, you have to read the book. You know, that will be too much to speak that now. Mm-hmm. But in conclusion, before going, if you have any questions, what we can say is that while certainty, Guru and Sadhu hold very in primary importance for us in many ways and in many instances, Shastra is of paramount importance in ascertaining doctrinal matters, siddhantic issues. No? What is what? What's the conclusion on this topic? And also, Shastra is fundamental for building the type of faith that we want to develop, Shastriya Shraddha, faith in revelation. Because that faith is the one that will take us to engage in bhakti, to engage in sadhana in a particular way and towards our ultimate goal, in our Gaudiya Sampradaya. So anyhow, some thoughts I want to share. This is just one of the topics of the book, although the book mainly officially speaks about whether bhakti is inherent or not, actually speaks about many other topics in the context of that topic. And this is one of them. So I, by the inspiration of some devotees and suggestion, I've chosen to focus in this particular direction today. So I don't know if you have any questions or comments or doubts or something you may like to share. Hands raising. Yeah.
Thank you, Pete.
I mean, I will have time for also, no problem.
I'm wondering, one of the things, I've just started your book. I've made through the first chapter, so I'm still kind of in the beginning. And I have a few questions, but I had the question of, isn't the Goswami Granta just sadhu? mm-hmm. you know, of that equation. You spoke to that. You spoke that, you know, it's been established in our sampradaya that, at least even in general Gaudiya's mm-hmm. followers of Mahaprabhu, mm-hmm. that they've been empowered to establish shastra.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, is there other, and probably in, throughout your book there's other ones, but if there's other pramanam, because from what some of the examples that I've heard are mainly from Jiva Goswami kind of clarifying in his Tattva-sandarbha, but I'm wondering, are there other examples in shastra that make this statement about the inherence or the non-inherence of bhakti in the jiva?
If there are examples in books other than the Goswami's
books, or I guess where does the bulk of that pramanam come from? Say if someone is having trouble accepting that Goswami Granta is also shastra,
mm-hmm.
if it's not just sadhu,
mm-hmm.
then why are the Goswami saying this? Does it line up with shastra?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, as I try to make the case on some level, and yes, in the book is further developed, for us the books of the Goswamis are our shastra, because for us to begin with, Goswamis are Nitya Siddha Parikars, who are eternal associates of Bhagavan, and who, if you want to call, okay, for us shastra is only the Bhagavatam, I mean not only, but the main shastric reference for us go, this is the Bhagavatam. Have no problem with that. But if you study the books of the Goswamis, it's actually explanations on the Bhagavatam. So it's not they are writing books separate from the Bhagavad. So in that way, I'm trying to make this point. Their books are basically an extension of the Bhagavatam. It's not that their own books on their own topics without considering our main Shastra Pramana. So one can make that case. Again, one can make the case that I made that Mahaprabhu commanded them to write these specific books as the architects of the Sampradaya. That's really unanimously accepted by all Gaudiyas. So that's my point. As Gaudiyas, we have that type of input regarding, okay, these are the books of the Goswamis. And they hold a special position. But let's say that even someone may say, okay, I don't care for the Goswamis. Hopefully nobody says that. But let's be hypothetical for a minute. I only want to go to the Bhagavatam. Okay, let's go to the Bhagavatam, only the Bhagavatam. You go to the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it's saying Satsanga Labdhaya Bhaktya, for example, which means bhakti is attained by sadhusanga. Satsanga Labdhaya, Labdhaya means to attain. That word Labdhaya is seen even in the Bhagavad Gita. Brahma Bhuta Prashanatmana Sochatina Kangshati Sarva Sarvesu Bhutesu Mad Bhaktim Labhati Param. Labhati means to attain, mad bhaktim, Krishna mm-hmm. said, attains my bhakti. Mm-hmm. So how you can attain something that you have?
That you're made of.
Mm-hmm. So Bhagavatam is making the same point. Satsanga labdhaya bhaktya, bhakti is attained by sadhu sangha. Whereas we were discussing, I think yesterday in Golok Premdam, muktim dadarti karhichits mana bhakti yogam, another line in the Bhagavatam. Krishna gives mukti relatively easy, but he does not give bhakti that easily.
Mm-hmm.
So again, someone is giving you that means you don't have. Or then in my first chapter, I quote, maybe the second chapter, sorry, I quoted the Bhagavatam which says, bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya, another famous line, which means bhakti comes from bhakti,
mm-hmm.
which is another way of saying bhakti comes from bhakta, mm-hmm. from the sadhu sangha, he who has bhakti. So I'm just sharing a few quotes. I share much more from the Bhagavatam. If we want to make the case, okay, let's dismiss the Goswamis as shastra, and if only Bhagavatam is shastra, okay, let's go with the Bhagavatam, no problem. There are many verses which clearly mention this idea that one receives, attains, and so on, gives, Krishna gives. But again, I will make the case that we have to understand that the Goswamis are paramount. The Goswamis' books are of paramount importance for us. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur at the end of Raghavarma Chandrika makes this point. No, like the books of the Goswamis are on an equal level with the Bhagavatam for us Gaudiyas. So, some thoughts in that connection.
Yeah.
And of course, there are other books that I'm referring to in my book. For example, there's one famous verse from Vishnu Purana, which is quoted twice by Jiva Goswami, once in Bhagavad Sandarbha, once in Krishna Sandarbha, and it says Ladini Shakti Sandini Sambit Twayika. It's basically Dhruva Maharaj is praying there to Krishna, and he's saying, Ladini, Sandini, and Sambit exist only in you. Mm-hmm. Which Ladini, Sambini, and Sambit are the three ingredients of Swarup Shakti, of which Bhakti is its essence. So he says, only in you, Bhagavan, there is Sandini, Sambit, and Ladini. And Sridhar Swami, famous Bhagavad commentator, he also wrote a commentary on Vishnu Purana. So in his commentary to that verse, he's saying, Swarup Shakti is only in Bhagavan, not in the Jivas. So, I mean, if you want something clearer than that, it's okay. Yeah.
So in that sense, mm-hmm. I think I was, this was coming up for me the other day as I was kind of thinking about the conversation, and I seeing when devotees are kind of disturbed by this conversation, like you're mentioning, like I'm speaking something from Shastra, and then if you're being disturbed, then what kind of faith? But I'm wondering if some of that disturbance may be from this sense that, as if we're having the conversation, isn't it that we can kind of understand or kind of, I guess, take for granted that bhakti has been given to us if we're even interested in this conversation? Or at what level of shraddha, sadhu, sangha, bhajana, kriya is bhakti actually given? Does that make sense?
I'm not so sure if I got the gist of it.
I guess in gist... if one's having this conversation about inheritance, there's some indication then that they've had sadhu sangha.
Yeah.
So is it then to be assumed that most people having the conversation, you can almost assume that there's bhakti has been, they've already been kind of given bhakti.
Yeah.
And they're kind of in that process of nourishing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then kind of and like a follow-up to that is like, when is bhakti given then? Is it given in shraddha? Or is it given in sadhu sangha or bhajana kriya? Or is it not stereotyped?
I mean, generally, I address that, I think, in the second chapter of my book, so it's coming.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to limit all my replies to read second chapter, read page 200, do your homework, but just in case you have some reference there. When Srila Rupa Goswami describes the nine stages of bhakti from Shraddha to Prem, and he begins saying, Ato Ado Shraddha. So Ado means in the beginning, is Shraddha, and Baladev Vidyabhushan interprets that Adho in the beginning as a first sadhu sangha. Because we have Shraddha, sadhu sangha, bhajana kriya, anartha nivritti nishtha rucha sakti prem. But before Shraddha, there is an unofficial sadhu sangha, if you will, where you receive your first bhakti samskars, if you will, devotional impression, even without knowing that's going on. But that's going on, even if you don't have that knowledge. Jiva Goswami in the Bhakti Sandarbha gives the example of Narad Muni before becoming Narad Muni in the series of previous lifetime that he himself narrated in the Bhagavatam, when he was the son of the maid servant, and he was with his mother as a child, and this, in the words of Prabhupada, the Bhakti Vedantas came, these great personalities who stayed for Chaturmasya, and Narad was a child and was just like not aware of what was going on, but he was just there, hearing the sadhus, taking the remnants, not thinking, okay, this is sadhu sangha, and this will take me to a progress or whatever. It's just, he was there, and the sadhus came. So he was receiving his first sadhu sangha, if you want to put it like that. He was receiving bhakti, even without his acknowledgement of that. And of course, that eventually fructified, and we have Narad Muni, if you want to put it like that. So bhakti will come to us out of its own accord, Jadrichaya, and that's also mentioned in the second chapter. No, bhakti has its own independent will and comes to our lives even without us knowing about that. And eventually, by the grace of that sadhu sangha, we develop some faith in that, and we officially look for further sadhu sangha in an intentional way. In the beginning, we have no intention of looking for sadhu sangha because we don't have even a clue what sadhu sangha. So we could say that will be the beginning of bhakti, which of course we cannot say if that began for us in this lifetime or a previous one. At that point, you cannot make the whole math, but it has a beginning at some point in that case, in our non-beginningless journey, Brahmanda Brahmitikon. Yes, in time.
There's I want to first say some appreciation. I'm still in the first half of the book, and I have a lot of appreciation just from the very beginning, because recognizing the effect that the inherent mentalities had on my own practice, in seeing that actually it's in different nuanced ways, when I experience bhakti in others, and I'm operating under the context that it's inherent, then their bhakti is like a threat, because it makes me question the inherence of my own bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the inheritance, actually, it's a great opportunity to relish bhakti sukriti, mm-hmm. and the bhakti shakti emanating from devotees.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's just a very powerful... I felt immediately relieved reading every page.
Mm-hmm.
Because it like really honestly purified me of the subtle like trying to dig for something inside myself that isn't actually there.
Mm-hmm.
And one question, which of course now like I've heard from Praman that we understand that actually praying that bhakti isn't inherent in Tathashta Chakti. So there's no, it's only from. So, but nonetheless, one doubt was in my mind, and whether I'll frame it like why these statements are there, or why this sort of context is often given in the statements of purification. For instance, bhakti is not inherent; it's inherited. So my question is, why is there so much emphasis on purification if we're in the mood of inheriting bhakti shakti,
mm-hmm.
which seems more of like a pavritti thing, but there's a lot of emphasis on anartha navritti, and even Mahaprabhu's shikshasamam begins with cheto darpana marjanam, and it makes me wonder, why does it not start with some analogy of like sticking iron in a fire? Why is that not the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it cheto darpana marjanam? Because that very much feeds the conception of I'm uncovering, but instead I'm just uncovering a clean thing that may not have bhakti. Like, what is it that I'm uncovering?
Mm.
And why so much emphasis on purification?
Mm. Okay, thank you. Good question. So, thanks for your appreciation as well. Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I agree that in some places you will find lots of emphasis on purification, but that's not necessarily the case in every, how to say, sangha or place. I mean, it's not. Of course, in Shastra there are some statements like the one you mentioned, and we will speak about that. But it's not that necessarily every single sangha or practitioner or individual will like address their practice with that degree of
mm-hmm.
you have to purify. And of course, I understand that maybe if you think already the thing is there and you have just to uncover, then you have to purify, you have to take all the dirt, because,
yeah.
Which of course that may be problematic, as we know, because if I have prem here, how prem can be covered to begin
mm-hmm.
with? I mean, how prem can be covered by Maya?
Right.
As I was speaking the other day with someone, and I asked someone, I won't mention names, but do you think prem is inherent? And the person said, yes. So we already have prem, we already have rasa, we have ready relationship with Krishna. Yes. So where's that? I mean, why am I here? Well, because of Maya. But so you think that prana can be covered by Maya? And the reply was yes. And I was like, again? Prana can be covered by Maya? Yes. So, okay. I mean, if prana can be covered by Maya, why am I doing what I'm doing? To attain prema and maybe be covered by Maya after attaining prema. I mean, I'm struggling in sadhana to attain a goal that eventually can be covered by Maya, even if you have prema.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have prema and be covered by Maya, means, I don't know, Subal, Madhumangal, Yashoda can be covered by Maya at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to practice Raganuga Bhakti, because Raganuga Bhakti means to follow someone who can be covered by Maya. What if I'm trying to follow Rupa Manjari and Rupa Manjari falls in Maya? And I have no more role, referent role to follow. Mm-hmm. Because that one Huat Prem became covered by Maya. So that's a dangerous proposition, basically. So the point is, we sometimes may mention these ideas, but we have to play out the implications of that. Now, if I say Prem can be covered by Maya, which is the full implication of that? Everyone who has Prem can be covered by Maya. Krishna can be covered by Maya. Radha can be covered by Maya. Gaur Nityananda can be covered by Maya. I mean, Prem is the way to transcend Maya. Not Maya will be covering Prem. That makes no sense. You follow my... I mean, I'm trying to be as commonsensical as... I'm not wanting to torture with quotes. I could do that, but... But Prem attracts Krishna. Sri Krishna Akarshini. So if Prem attracts Krishna... I mean, Prema helps us to transcend Maya. But that's a secondary thing. Mainly, it attracts the all-attractive. What to speak of dismissing Maya? So how can you say that Maya can cover Prem? Mm. That makes no sense. And of course, that's tied with the idea. If Maya can cover Prem, then you can fall from Golok Vrindavan, which again is not our Siddhanta. Mm. Nobody can fall from Vaikuntha. Mm. That creates some other problems, but that's another conversation. So regarding your question, again, I will say, you will find in different sanghas or practitioners different emphasis, and probably the background for that emphasis or not emphasis is maybe a different opinion in this connection. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, I get your point. If we know, okay, Prem is not inherent, and bhakti is received all as a gift. Nonetheless, I mean, we can speak about purifying ourselves so we can better receive that mm-hmm. gift. Sri Gaur Govinda Maharaj will give this analogy of you have received the full thing, but he gave, again, an analogy, like your heart is like a container, so bhakti is being poured on that container, but the container has holes. No? Mm-hmm. So the container is filled, and you say, wow, it's filled, but after a few minutes it's like, whoa, mm-hmm. what's going on? So I need to cover, if you will, those holes, yeah. And in that way we speak about purifying ourselves. Mm-hmm. No? And also Mahaprabhu mentions Chetu Darpana Marjanam, because in that verse, which is the first verse of Shikshastakam, he's enumerating seven effects of Sankirtan. Mm-hmm. So the first one is, he's not saying so much, he's not like emphasizing this has to happen, he's mostly saying what will happen as a result of engaging in Sankirtan. Uh-huh. So in order, first thing, Chetu Darpana Marjanam. Which interestingly, Chetu Darpana Marjanam means, as you know, Marjanam means to clean, Darpana means mirror, and Chetu comes from Chitta, which technically speaking could be referred to in today's psychological language as the subconscious. So, Mahaprabhu is saying, first effect of Srinam is it will clean the subconscious. It will clean the dust. We know there's lots of stuff in the subconscious. As we were speaking the other day, a little bit joking with the devotees, I think, Golok Premadam, that our I compared the subconscious with the, how do you call that? That place in your house where you put all like the stuff.
Junk drawer.
There was some awesome. Other name.
Basement?
I don't know. That is some room outside the house that you put.
Shed,
that was the word. Shed, that was the word. So that's the shed, no? Uh-huh. Where you don't know where to put some stuff in your house, put that in the shed.
Just toss it in there. Yeah.
But at some point you have put so much stuff there, there's no more place for that, and you close the shed and you no longer know what's going on inside there. Yeah. And after a few days you start to hear voices coming from the shed. No, it's taking its own, a life of its own. And you get closer and you see some arm coming, it's what's going on there. I don't want to enter in the shed. So that's kind of the analogy for the subconscious. Now, some things that we don't want to confront, so we have even that mechanism. Throw it to the shed. Yeah, okay. Remember, everything's nice. Paka. Paka, but the shed is not paka. So the point is, the first effect of Srinam will be like a broom will start to move that dust. And of course, it may be perceived even as oh, this is a problem, what's going on? This thing that I didn't want to see is coming to the foreground, mm-hmm. and I don't want, but you're invited to take responsibility for that. No? That's, mm-hmm. So again, it's not necessarily that with that Mahaprabhu is making like an exaggerated uh-huh. emphasis on you have to purify yourself, but basically he's saying, this is the first thing that will happen when you start to chant. But your main focus is chant and mm-hmm. try to chant properly in good association. But this will be the byproducts of that mm-hmm. along the way in different mm-hmm. stages. But yeah, I agree that our main emphasis should be in trying to practice, as we spoke a little bit yesterday, in a positive way, not so much like in a negative way, like trying to get rid of, mm-hmm. not conceiving the practice as getting rid of, because that's more like in a negative orientation to the practice. Mm. And anartha nibriti actually is not a practice in it unto itself. Mm. I mean, you don't practice anartha nibriti. Mm. You engage in bhajan kriya. Anartha nibriti is the result of that at one stage. It's not, I will do anartha nibriti. What does it mean? If you say, I will chant, that's bhajan kriya. That's not anartha nibriti. Mm-hmm. Anartha nibriti is the result of bhajan kriya. Mm. So the focus is bhajana kriya. Mm-hmm. Anartha nibriti comes out of its own accord. Mm-hmm. And we have to have that faith that by embracing the practice properly, these byproducts will come naturally. I don't have even to be extremely concerned. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like to say that for us anartha nibriti will mean that while we are engaging in bhajana kriya, we have the sincerity to acknowledge, as much as I can see, which things do I have to transcend? Which are the things that I have to work on at this stage? Because we have to do some work of integrity and recognition. Okay, which state I am? Which is the present day anartha, if you will, the main thing I have to work on? To acknowledge that, to have the courage of acknowledging and not just like nothing is going on and maybe you want to experience ecstatic symptoms, but it's not the moment yet for that. I've seen sometimes devotees getting discouraged because with what intention, but they are practicing, but they are idealizing this and this should be happening in my practice. But they are idealizing certain things that correspond with the stage of Ruchi, for example. And they don't realize I haven't reached Nishta yet. Mm-hmm. So I'm expecting something that will come 3 stages after. So I get discouraged because that's not coming. Mm-hmm. But something is coming, which is corresponding to the stage I am. So it's important to know where we are in the map, mm-hmm. in the journey. Mm-hmm. That's why, for me, books like Madhura Kadambini are very interesting because it's a very clear depiction of where you are. And you read the whole thing. If you have a little bit of sincerity, you will be able to recognize, okay, that's me. I'm there. I'm there, but I want to be, I should be here. Middle-term goal, long-term goal. It's important to establish these goals also in our lives. Not only where we are, but where do we want to be? Short-term, middle-term. Yeah, long-term, prem bhakti. But maybe it's too much if we just try to, okay, I have to reach prem bhakti, I have to reach prem bhakti. First, I have to reach nishta. I think that's more relatable to where we are. If we are not yet there yet, then middle term, long term, that's more sustainable. Yes.
I have a question. First, I don't really want to, because it's like your topic was really specific, and I really appreciated how Sat Sri Chaitanya found it. I'm sure your book. I only looked through it. But it set such a strong foundation, and it was funny because when you were speaking, actually, when you said which one is on the top, I did think, I was like, where is on the top? And it makes so much sense that even you're sort of presenting it as like, you know, the supports almost, like that the goal is the shop, Krishna, you know, like Krishna speaks, and then these are kind of your balancing supports to help you. So I really appreciated that, but I just wanted to hear from you in person because this I thought was such a fascinating thing. I was flipping through and I just saw this drawing a line from bhakti to rasa, you know, And because I have heard, you know, I've heard the fall of the Jiva argument and so on, and actually that was like very disturbing for me at the very beginning of my book.
Oh, yeah.
But it actually led me to the Bodhiyamana and away from ISKCON because I was so frustrated about it.
Hmm.
But what's so interesting is that even within that Sangha, or certain aspects of that Sangha, they still have this point that but rasa is somehow inherent.
Hmm.
And I wanted to hear more from you about that drawing the line, how bhakti to rasa, to, you know, to svarup, like, if you would speak some about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's, I mean, of course, it's in the book also, I'll say some words. I just want to confirm which number of chapter 5, I think. Chapter 5, yeah, is rasa predetermined. No? So there is a whole chapter on rasa. Then the next chapter is about siddha deha. I mean, it's the same thing, but I try to approach it from different sides. So bhakti, prem, rasa, siddha deha. Yes.
How would you have rasa?
You don't have rasa. That's my reply to that. And I understand that someone may be saying that. Again, I'm aware that some people will say, again, bhakti is inherent, prem is inherent, rasa is inherent, siddha deha is inherent. Because generally, the ones who say bhakti is inherent will say everything else is inherent, generally. Generally. No? Again, there are different opinions. It's not even one and the second. There are many in between. But the idea is, of course, that if bhakti is not inherent, rasa is not inherent, because rasa is bhakti rasa. I mean, rasa is the ultimate expression of bhakti, if you want to put it like that.
Bhakti grows into rasa.
Exactly. You know, technically speaking, the goal of our life is not even prem, but it's bhakti rasa, which is a combination. I mean, I don't want to become too technical and keep torturing you, already torturing considerably. But if you study Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu of Rupa Goswami, he very elaborately describes Bhakti Rasa. Stai Bhav, Bibhav, Anubhav, Satvika Bhav, Vyabhichari Bhav, all these ecstatic elements put together, combined in a particular way, will give the experience of Rasa. And to begin with, it's Stai Bhav. So, Stai Bhav means like a fixed emotion for Krishna. Fixed not in the sense that it's already fixed, but eventually it becomes your defining bhav towards Krishna. And that, combined with these other elements, gives us a result experience of Bhakti Rasa. So, my point is that Bhakti Rasa is the ultimate blossoming of bhakti. Now, if you want to speak in terms of, as Mahaprabhu did, of the seed and the vine, no? He starts saying what? Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Beach. He gives the analogy of the Bhakti Lata Beach, the vine, you say? Vine of,
yeah.
of love of bhakti. The first thing he's saying, Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Beach. Now, that seed of the vine of bhakti is given by the guru to the disciple. So that seed, eventually he gives all this analogy, starts to grow, and eventually it fully blossoms at the end in the form of bhakti rasa.
Can I, just to clarify the question that I've
seen? Yes.
Then they say, like, there's this book, Srila Bhaktivedanta Maharaj's Disciples Gopal, and of, like, his quotations on the subject, that because then they say, no, the Jiva didn't fall, but then they say that
Mm-hmm.
So would you say, like, it's not, because they say that seed is what the jiva is, But you're saying that type of bhakti.
I mean,
bhakti.
I'm not saying I'm quoting Krishna Dakaraj Goswami that the seed is being given. Of course, it's an analogy, and I know that they make the analogy that we have the seed, and the sadhu sangha is like the water. But again, these are analogies, so we can present all analogies that we want. That's not the way to establish Siddhanta. Siddhanta is not established through analogies, or not even through my guru said, as I tried to make the point in the very beginning, because if not, I mean, you will tell me my guru said, and I will tell you my guru said, and we are not really dialogue, having a dialogue. And interestingly, I am friends with many disciples of Srila Narayan Maharaj, and not all of his followers have the same opinion on this topic, interestingly. And I have many of them who fully agree with the points in my book. No, and I even compare, and I presented in my book, for example, some statements by Srila Narayan Maharaj, let me share you a few, which, at least for me, doesn't seem to be like bhakti inherent. No? So, for example, let me see where it is. He said, bhakti is also not the bliss inherent in the living entity's constitutional nature, since that bliss is extremely minute, and consequently, Bhagavan cannot become overpowered by it. Mm. Also, he says, bhava is an eternally accomplished phenomenon. It always exists in the nitya parikars, or eternal associates of Bhagavan. This nitya siddha bhava manifests itself from the Lord's eternal associates into the heart of the purified jiva. Or, I don't know, he said, Vasudev Krishna had appeared in the heart of Vasudev, and Vasudev had impregnated Devaki by mantra. This is called Sambandha Gyan. The guru gives his disciple a relationship with Krishna by mantra. One more. Last one. Rati is Visuddha Sattva. It does not come from the heart of the sadhaka. It has to come down from the heart of a ragatmika bhakta. Rati is not in our hands. It is in the hands of devotees who are certainly Krishna bhaktas, and only they can give it.
I have so many questions. I don't know if I'll be able to be here. Could I ask one more?
Yes, why not?
Okay, thank you. I really appreciate this. Somehow this came up recently, not so long ago, discussing with Deva Madhupu and also with Lee Balakru about this topic and some time ago, but there's a question people often quote this thing from Jayavidharma, where the guru appears in different ways to different disciples. So then if it's from that guru, say, who's giving the bhakti and the bhakti rasa,
well, of course, there are many ways to express, to explain that, but one of them is, of course, if we agree that bhakti is not inherent, that that's received, if you will, the particular devotional affinity I have will be received by those sadhus that mostly influence my life, then we will think, okay, so if one guru has one particular affinity, all his disciples will have that affinity that their guru has, and that will be generally the rule. Now that say, there can be exceptions to the rule, and in that case, how to explain them? Well, very easily, that devotee may have had bhakti samskar from previous lifetimes, which are strong enough as to be different from that of his present guru.
Shamananda.
This place, again, there are exceptions to the rule, but you have Shamananda being attracted towards Madhurya Bhav, while his guru Hidaya Chaitanya was in Sakya Bhav, or I don't know, well, not everyone may agree with this, but according to my perspective and that of my Guru Maharaj and Srila Siddhar Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada has affinity towards Sakya Bhav, and his Gurudev has affinity towards Madhurya Bhav. So there you have a case. Again, there may be exceptions to the rule, but I mean, there's possible, and in that way you can explain that in connection to whether you like to think, okay, there are nitya siddhas and coming already with that mood, like, I don't know, Mahaprabhu trying to convert Murari Gupta. And of course he couldn't, because Murari Gupta is Hanuman. So how you will convert Hanuman, how you will convince Hanuman, stop serving Ram? I mean, that's not a good project.
But it's simply, you're saying it's simply on the basis of samskara for samskara, because he's eternally, it's hard to announce.
Yeah, in the case of Hanuman, that's an exception, because he's eternal, nitya siddha. So it's a different category of jivas, basically. But in the case of Tathasta Jiva, we can speak about, yeah, that person received Bhakti Samskara from previous lifetimes. I mean, Rupa Goswami says in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, if you want to taste Bhakti Rasa, minimum you require one more previous life of having acquired enough Bhakti Samskaras, so in the next one you taste Bhakti Rasa. So he's making these points of previous lifetimes of impressions, so...
When I feel like the dynamics too of rasa, where, for instance, like in the case of Srila Prabhupada being attracted to Sakya rasa, I've heard also just, you know, more specifically like this Priyanama Saka, right, where there is some Madhurya in there. So he's having this, you know, samskaras from his guru, who's also in Madhurya Bhav, right? And so all of those things are mixing in, and rasa's dynamic, at least, you know, from what I've understood from hearing. So it's... It's not going to be like, oh, I'm in this camp, so therefore that's the influence.
It's exactly.
In a crooked way.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. In that particular case, we could see it like that. You know, Prabhupada had those Sakyarasa scars, and the influence and association of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta gave the Madhurya ingredient to the equation. So you mix Sakya with Madhurya, and you have Priyanarma Sakya, which is those type of friends of Krishna who are assisting him in his romantic exploits, if you will. So she go nitai ki ja. So that's possible for sure. And Srila Prabhupada said that his Siksha Guru was Srila Siddha Maharaj, who also had affinity towards Madhurya Bhav. So, but again, there's not a conflict. Again, it's not like Kurus versus Pandavas or something like this. Especially Sakya Madhurya Rasa, Rupa Goswami says in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, these two rasas are friendly with each other. Some other rasas are considered enemies. Not enemies because they are fighting in the lila, but they are not compatible regarding, I don't know, for example, Vatsalya and Madhurya, they are not compatible. Mm-hmm. One practical example is at night, when Krishna is supposed to go to sleep, Yashoda wants, may my lal has a sound sleep whole night. She wants Krishna to sleep. But the gopis have another plan in mind. No? See you in the organized spot for Rasa Lila this night. So one group wants something, the other group wants something different. May you sleep, may you remain awake the whole night with us. Of course, one is not knowing what is going on in the other place, not in the case of Yashoda, but the point is, there is no conflict, but they have different ideas about that. But regarding Sakya Bhav, Krishna's friends will totally agree with, I mean, not all of Krishna's friends know about that section, but those who know are totally actually facilitating somehow or other that to happen. So, well, he had a question and he left, I think, or he's returning.
I don't remember his name.
Okay. If he returns, we will give him priority. He's returning. You had a question.
You touched on it a little bit, Maharaj, in a sense. There's the different categories of jivas, like some are nitya siddhas, and then there's, and I forgot the term, but most of the jivas. So is it inherent or inherited in the nitya siddhas, in a sense, you know what I mean, because they're not able to lose it, so does that?
Yeah.
And then while the rest of the jivas...
I mentioned in my book that, for example, I present the idea that we are Tathasta Jivas, we are Tathasta Shakti, but we could speak that there are some Jivas. Actually, the term Jiva is not technically correct in related to eternal associates, because Jivas in Shastra are defined by Atmas who are affected by Maya Shakti. So, regarding eternal associate Nitya Parishads, we could make the case that there are Nitya Parishads who are not Tathasta, but who are made of Swarup Shakti. In itself, they are made of Swarup Shakti. They are, like, for example, Radha is, of course, Swarup Shakti personified, and the gopis are considered her kaha vyuha, like personal expansions of Radha. So if Radha is a personification of Swarup Shakti, those gopis are also personification of Swarup Shakti. They're not tatastha. They don't belong to that category of Shakti, tatastha Shakti, but Swarup Shakti. Or when Rupa Goswami defines Raganuga Bhakti, now what does it mean to practice Raganuga Bhakti? To follow Ragatmikas. The Ragatmikas was the idea of Ragatmika. Them, those whose Atma is made of Raga. So that means those whose very self is made of love for Krishna. So that, again, we can make the case they are made of Swarup Shakti, not of Tatastha Shakti. So in that, but also, to further complicate more the thing, Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami, the Sandarbhas, also make the point. Most of the Nityas, he says, there can be Nitya Siddhas who are Tatastha Shakti also. Like he gives the example of Garuda. Huh. Interestingly. So you can be a Nitya Siddha, and probably the rule will be most of them will be made of Swarup Shakti. But there can be some made of Tatastha Shakti, but who are Nitya Siddha, who have been forever there. No? I told you, I will complicate more the whole stuff.
Take it to the edge till intellect gives up.
Okay, that's a good symptom.
It collapses.
He raised the hand a little bit. Let's take some turns.
Well, my question isn't really, it's sort of, I apologize for sort of breaking the flow, but just a quick question, maybe somebody else too over Prashad after this could help answer this too if it's more appropriate. But my question, Swami, was just pertaining to, so there's different levels of, say a devotee goes through different levels of devotion or sort of different stages of, I guess, what they achieve or experience through devotion. I'm just wondering if there's a certain text or something. I know recently you told me to read the Nectar of Instruction. And maybe it's in there, but if there's a certain text where I could learn more about the succession, the different stages mm-hmm. that I would go through so I can understand better mm-hmm. where I'm at and sort of where I'm mm-hmm. heading.
Yeah, I see. Well, I would recommend the one that I mentioned, which is the Madhurya Kadambini, which is a very, of course, in itself is a short text, and generally there are commentaries written to it, which really help to clarify. But this text is like because these main nine stages we speak about generally are coming in two verses written by Rupa Goswami, but he does not elaborate on those verses. He just mentioned the stages and continues speaking other topics. But this Madhurya Kadambini by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he takes those two verses and make a whole book out of them, basically, and tries to unpack from the very beginning. I mean, the very beginning of Madhurya Kadambini is basically how bhakti comes to us. And he makes this point, bhakti comes from bhakti. And then he starts to analyze Shraddha, Sadhu Sangha, Bhajana Kriya, Nartani, everything till Prem. So that's a very good one. Of course, Upadeshamrita, the Nectar of Instruction, although it's not speaking in terms of these nine stages, somehow it's also giving some like sequence, not beginning from control the impulse of speech and reside eternally in Radhakunda in 11 verses. Don't speak gossip and Lila Smaranam or something. It's interesting also. So that's also, that may be also even a good one to begin with before going to something like Madhurya Kadambini.
Okay.
Because it's also quite practical and giving very interesting advice regarding do's and don'ts, if you will, and how to relate and very simple, basic things which are, I mean, sometimes simple and basic are not that simple and basic. So we need to go back to those things many times. So, I will encourage, and of course they have recommended that one to you first, so that's a good one. And maybe at some point Madhurya Kadambini can be an interesting one. You can ask the local assembly here, but yeah. I'm sure that may
we
be...
We have both of those books.
Okay.
Awesome.
Yeah, but it's important to know where we are, the symptoms of the journey, basically, because you may be feeling something and not knowing how to explain to yourself what's going on, why this is happening, why do I feel like this, it's okay to feel like this, is it wrong, I'm doing something wrong, And something in that book, just a brief mention that I always liked a lot by Vishwanatha Chakrabarti Thakur, is that when he describes anishchita bhajana kriya, which means unstable practice of bhakti, which basically is where 99% is there, is in, I always joke with the devotees when I explain those that stage, which has six symptoms, utsamayi, ganataral, and so on. And I start to tell them, okay, you raise your hand if you identify with each one of them. So I start, number one, everyone, shh. Number two, number three, they start to take chaturbhuj, four arms. They go. So somehow they bring some extra arms and hands. So I say, well, it's good. I mean, we're getting somewhere. It's good to find. Okay, I'm there. And the good point is, as embarrassing as that may be, that's part of the process. Mm. I mean, that's happening in the context of bhakti. Mm. So in one sense, it's glorious. Because it's bhakti in my life. Although you hear the symptoms of these stages and it's like, oh my God, yeah, it's me. Oh, yeah, also. But at the same time, that's in the context of bhakti. So that's glorious. So we are not to feel like extremely ashamed or enter into a guilt trip. But understand, actually this has to happen. At some point I have to go through that. Vishwanatha Chakrabarti Thakur is including those stages as part of the journey. It's not that you can just jump the embarrassing chapter of anisthita bhajana kriya and just land into ecstatic waters of bhava or something. No, you have to embrace those stages. And he's confirming it's okay to go through them. I mean, you have to. It's not the ultimate goal. The problem is when you say, okay, I stay here. Hopefully you don't want to stay there because it's pretty embarrassing. But but it's not wrong to go through there. I mean, actually, it's a symptom that something is going on. You are becoming awake and, okay, I'm realizing all that I have to deal with. So in one sense, it's glorious. In one sense, it's embarrassing. In other sense, it's glorious, even though it sounds paradoxical. Yeah, so that's glorious. That's as we were speaking yesterday with the devotees. Now, we, at the end of the day, for us Sadhu Sangha, let's sit together and share how we failed today or how we could do better tomorrow. So that may be embarrassing, no? How I fail, quote-unquote fail, again. Try to be careful of the terms. How can I do better tomorrow? Mm. And you will open your heart, express your vulnerability, as we said the other day, so much empowerment will come from that. So it's embarrassing, but it's empowering. Mm. So those two things do not kill each other, if you will. There's place for for a combination of them, too. So. Anyhow.
Thank you.
No, thank you. So, something else? I mean, we are already 1 hour and a half, but we can go. Yeah, what's your name, sorry?
Sumakadasa. I wanted to thank you, first of all, for the class and for the book. As many here, I've started it, but not had the chance to dive more deeply into it. But I was wondering if in your studies or your inquiries into the scriptures of the the Goswamis, you encountered this type of question in relation to the concept of time, and by time I mean in the sense of eternal time, because sometimes I feel like the preoccupation with the when, like is it before, is it after, does it happen here, does it happen there, is very much related to our experience of time, which is linear or circolinear in a sense. Mm-hmm. So we're always thinking, is it here or is it here in our journey, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But when we read, for example, I'm thinking the Brahma Samhita 5.56, is described how time, so not even half a moment is lost. So it's there is no past, not half a moment is... passes, so it's kind of I don't know how to put it, and I don't know the Goswami scriptures enough to go into that, but it's like an eternal present, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm-hmm. So that preoccupation that we have here from this standpoint, mm-hmm. from this mm-hmm. world, mm-hmm. of when, where does it happen, is it before, after, will we go up and down, is related to our understanding, while from the perspective of the spiritual world, so to speak, is eternal presence. So it doesn't matter if one is a nitya siddha or is a sadhana siddha. And even the very question of is it before, is it after, did one arrive now, mm-hmm. did it arrive later, mm-hmm. or was mm-hmm. the body there, was the body not there,
mm-hmm.
and all these topics that seem to become very controversial here.
They are not controversial there, for sure.
Exactly. So I was wondering how if these questions are seen, are pivoted on the concept of eternal time, how things would play, or if the Goswamis discuss with this dimension as well.
Mm. Okay. You have 3 more hours?
Yes.
That's a long topic. I'll give some brief 10 minutes with the blessings of the boss here. So, yeah, the topic of time is discussed in the Goswami's books, for sure. Jiva Goswami speaks about that in his Sandarbhas, in other places as well. And of course, as you mentioned, it's very different. The function of time as we know it here in our three-dimensional plane, and time basically, as Krishna was saying, the Gita, devouring everything. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's the notion we have here of time, if you will. No? Like, you lost 1 second past, you cannot recover that. No? Shajurharati vaipunsham udhyanastanchayanasavtasyartakshatranantrautama shlokavartya bhagavatam, say famous verse. Every rising and setting of the sun, your life is being stolen. That's a heavy language of the Bhagavatam. No? Every time the sun rises and goes, there's a message for you. No? One day less. Okay. Of course, the verse then says, except for those who glorify Bhagavan. For those, time is not passing. And the commentators give the extreme example of, you have the Kumaras, 4 Kumaras, who of course were Brahma Gyanis, but eventually became devotees, and they remain eternally as boys. They are not affected by time. You know, like implying, for those who remain deeply engrossed in Hari Kirtan, not affected by time. So, here again, time is having a particular function. The word kala can mean time, and kala can mean death also, which is basically not far one from another. That's our side of experience, you know, and past, present, future, and so on. Now, in the spiritual world, and I know this may not be a topic easy to grasp, in the sense of, as much as we are still affected by time here, it will be difficult to conceive something apart from that. That's why Bhaktivinoda Thakur sometimes, regarding these things, will say, this will be solved finally in meditation. No? Like, in other words, like when your mind goes beyond duality and the gunas, you will fully have a direct experience of some of these concepts. So in the spiritual world, there is time, but there is not a time that is degenerating. Degenerating, you say? Mm-hmm. As long as it's passing, it's not that the inhabitants of Braj are becoming old, no, and so on. But there is day, there is night, and there is a passing of time in a cyclical way, which is facilitating the dynamics of the lila. Because if there's no day and night, there's no rasa lila, there's no meeting at Radha Kund in the midday, there's no this astakaliya dynamic that happens, eightfold division of the day, in out, the bingolo. So time is there facilitating the unfolding of the lila, but it's not like contracting or devouring or nothing in that sense, but it's just, time is a devotee, if you want to put it like that. Time is serving the lila. No? When we speak about the sun and the moon in Golok Vrindavan, they are devotees. So they are appearing according to the necessity of the lila and facilitating. So that's the function of time there. There is one interesting article by Sadhananda Swami about that that comes to mind now. Maybe of your interest, maybe you can maybe later remind me and I can send that to you or something. Sadhananda Das, you know, Sadhananda Swami, he was
German
disciple of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta, interestingly. He wrote many interesting things. So yeah, I agree with your point that from the perspective of eternity, they're inhabiting this eternal present, and there's not this like notion of, okay, this happened, and that happened, if you will. Or as you mentioned, that was an interesting point where you mentioned nitya siddha, sadhana siddha, how you can establish the difference. Because sometimes from this side, I've heard the devotees like, okay, I don't know, my guru is a nitya siddha. If you suggest he's a sadhana siddha, I may jump on your neck or something. You are being offensive. Like if sadhana siddha is something wrong or something. And there's this very interesting quote. I shared that yesterday. That someone, one devotee, asked Srila Prabhupada this question. Someone asked Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, who is higher, the sadhana siddha or the nitya siddha? And Prabhupada replied very substantially, the important word there is siddha. Period. And apart from that, how you will figure out which is sadhana siddha or nitya siddha? You don't have like a litmus test to, okay, he's nitya siddha, this not sadhana siddha. And it's not that one is better than the other, even. Someone may say, no, it's better the one who was always liberated. Well,
what's always?
Sanatana Goswami says in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, the sadhana siddha has a special glory because his bhakti was put to test. He went through many challenges that the nitya siddha never did, went through.
So sadhana is better.
I mean, we don't want to create that dichotomy. That's just a go nityananda ki. But my point is, there are ways to see both of them in that light. No, at the end of the day, we are not to fight about these type of things. No, and of course, it is also mentioned that the subjective experience, when someone reaches that realm, if you want to put it like that, it's like, I've always been here, basically, subjectively speaking. Mm-hmm. No? It's not that you will be in Golok Vrindavan and you are remembering your previous life and your conditioned experience, because there are no samskars. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the material samskars have to be, first of all, clean for you to enter there. So you won't have any memory of conditioned existence. You follow my point? So the subjective individual experiences, I've been here forever. Interestingly. Mm-hmm. Again, from our side, that's another thing, and that's why we are engaging in all these complicated stuff conversations. But I can assure you that yes, the people in the Leela are not questioning if bhakti is inherent or not, or anything like that. No time for that, to be honest as well. But there's place for speaking about that from this. I mean, at least for me, I've written a whole book. Somehow I have to justify that. But of course, there's place also to become distracted by speaking about those things if it's not with the proper intention and focus. And I say told Namrasa once, not necessarily everyone has to read such a book or speak about those topics. It's not for everyone. Some people may say, why that is important? Well, if you feel like that, probably we don't have to speak about that. And it's okay. I'm not just trying to impose the topic on every person I'm crossing, no? Because I know it's... But I've seen that for many, that was important to be spoken about and clarify certain things which may have some other further implications, as we were speaking today with the Madhava, some interesting ideas. No? Like somehow we may think, which will be the repercussion of whether bhakti is inherent or not, or whether we fall from Vaikuntha or not, what's the importance of that? How will that affect my practice? And if you play out the implications of how that will affect your practice, that may even be affecting how you're treating your wife at home. Mm-hmm. There are so many layers of implications and even cultural biases and things that intermingle with one another without our knowledge. But when you start like to unpack all those things, you realize, oh my gosh, no? The idea of fall from grace has repercussions even in my daily domestic experience with my kids. Mm-hmm. There's place for that. And then you start to realize, okay, it may be good to have the proper notion about that point, because that may affect all my proper notions till my most pragmatic daily experiences. So,
like, I can't even read Shastra properly because I have a fundamental misconception of what I'm reading.
Mm-hmm. And the problem, if you have a certain misconception, you find that Shastra is saying something which contradicts your misconception, but you are sure about your misconception, who knows what you will do with that section of Shastra to accommodate to your misconception, and you may start to make a whole Neo Sampradaya, basically. And that's what sometimes we call Arva Sampradaya, that something may be created out of something which is not the proper Siddhanta, basically. I mean, Appa Sampradaya comes from Appa Siddhanta, multiplied by trillions, if you will. And sometimes that takes to Appa, 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 Appa. Should I offer the lamp to Maharaj or not? He's giving the class now. What to do?
Yes. I'm like, I'm ready.
I'm ready.
My husband here to Maharaj.
Give him the.
I want.
Okay.
If I could,
thank
Maharaj,
you.
I wanted to hear from you about Jiva Goswami's primacy. You did bring it up some, but that was one of the interesting elements to the last kind of 2 years.
Jiva Goswami's?
Jiva Goswami's primacy.
Primacy.
Kind of epistemology.
Yeah.
We often hear that we're Rupa Raghunath. And while there are some Prabhupada's statement, as you brought out, that Jiva Goswami is the world's greatest philosopher, and he kind of synthesized the canon of the other Goswamis. Still, up until maybe the last 2 years, I hadn't really heard of his primacy in the Sindarbha's kind of central position as establishing our Siddhanta and the Bhagavatam. Mm-hmm. So, if you could say a little more about that.
Yeah, I agree with that point that Jiva Goswami's somehow role and position in our Sampradaya has been somehow, I don't want to say downplayed, but just maybe innocently ignored.
Yeah.
And maybe because, in part, at least for some part of the community, because sometimes for some time his texts were not that available in Western languages, so that plays a role, like it or not.
Yeah.
So the more they became available, the more the community starts to become aware, okay, this is a pretty comprehensive, systematic presentation of the whole Bhagavatam, this is monumental. And you start to pay more close attention. And, for example, you find statements like, because I was speaking that day with Sandhavati about Sandarbhas, he said, no, for us the most important book is Chaitanya Charitamrita. And thing. Do you know that Chaitanya Charitamrita is greatly based on the Sandarbhas? Mm-hmm. I mean, Chaitanya Charitamrita is based on Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Ujjwala Nilamani, and Sat Sandarbhas. And by the way, if you want, I can tell you what Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami has to say about the Sandarbhas in Chaitanya Charitamrita 3.4.229. So he says, Bhagavat Sandarbha Namakaila Granta Sar Bhagavat Siddhantera Tahan Payapar. The Bhagavat Sandarbha, which is another name for the Sat Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami, is the essence of all scriptures. This word presents the limit of all Siddhanta concerning Bhagavan.
Yeah.
That's Chaitanya Charitamrita. So you read Chaitanya Charitamrita again if you say only Chaitanya Charitamrita. So, I mean, the essence of all scriptures and the limit of all Siddhanta. No? So that's something I will say.
Yes.
So I'm just quoting something that shows the role of Jiva Goswami's presentation as the Tattvacharya. And when you study the Sandarbhas, of course it's a dense work. It's not just something, give me a weekend and I finish it. Yeah, exactly. It takes years. Yeah. I'm studying it now for the last 3 years, and of course I'm not thinking, okay, when I finish, I don't need to study it again or something. So that's a monumental thing. And his presentation is extremely thorough and systematic and comprehensive. And it's an explanation of the Bhagavatam, because every single point he's making throughout the whole book, in each one of the Anuchedas or chapters, all of them starts with by referring to one verse of the Bhagavatam. And then he unfolds the particular point, always referring to the Bhagavatam. So that's basically a commentary on the Bhagavatam, presenting the main points of all our tradition, referring to the Bhagavatam, which is the center for us. And that's what he established in the first Sandarbha. That was Sandarbha speaking about Bhagavatam and this very source of Pramana for us, evidence. And then he goes Bhagavat Sandarbha, Paramatma Sandarbha, Krishna Sandarbha, Bhakti Sandarbha, Priti Sandarbha, establishing Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan, Bhagavan Sri Krishna, Braja Krishna. All that being Sambandha. The first Anucheda Sandarbha is Sambandha Gyan. Then Bhakti Sandarbha, Abhideya. Then Priti Sandarbha, Prayojan. But that's very detailed, a degree of detail. And he presents arguments to his points. Just the arguments to his point are like totally fiberglassing. It's like, how can he think of such an argument? Even the Purvapaksha he's representing in the argument may never come to that level of argumentation. So he himself, for the sake of his presentation, is presenting the most highly possible refined arguments, and then he defeats them. So he's doing all that work for us, basically, if you will. Even if you have some doubts, he will present a deeper doubt. He will solve that. He will solve that for you. So it's like really given like in a very interesting way.
I know that we're going to do more Q&A sessions.
This is quasi Q&A after the end of the class, but we'll have two classes only of Q&A.
I just want to maybe like say it so that we can touch on it another time, but
let's see.
This quote, you know, that sometimes devotees will sample from Srila Prabhupada, and I'd like to know the context of when Prabhupada was saying this, but he's saying first deserve, then desire.
Mm.
So then practically, because I think that's one thing that's been very exciting about my kind of becoming privy to this topic and understanding what our acharyas are saying in terms of that bhakti is being gained and molded by our sangha.
Mm.
It's being gained and given by the bhaktas.
Mm.
The application of, okay, what does it mean first deserve, then desire?
Mm-hmm.
And where does desire come into play in terms of this?
Can we leave it for the Q&A?
You
will be able to come?
I'll be, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because so we can unfold a little bit more. Now, we are almost 2 hours here, so. And you have one question also. What do you think? We can leave for the next one, or it will be difficult for you to come?
I don't know if I'll be here or not, but
she may pop any minute.
Yeah.
I feel guilty asking this question.
No guilt trip, please.
Anyway, I'm so afraid of like killing my own self and making an offense.
No offense, no fear, no guilt trip.
Question.
It's okay.
I was discussing with my husband at one point, he was saying in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, there's this verse that says, if one commits an offense, then one's, even if one has bhav in a particular rasa, then that can be downgraded.
Mm-hmm.
So the implication is that there is an actual hierarchy of the rasas.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the question is, I guess it's hard for me to understand just with my intellect. It's like, okay, if I'm not anything yet, you know, like I'm like a blank slate, right? Like in one sense, like I have some scars,
mm-hmm.
but hypothetically, if I haven't become anything yet, you know, I'm not, I don't have a svarup yet, then I could become anything, right?
I mean, I wouldn't frame it like that. It's not that you are not anything. Or that you don't have a swarup. I mean, there is a swarup and there is a bhakti swarup. The Atma has a swarup in itself. I mean, we are tatastha shakti, tatastha jiva. We are something, we are someone. And that there is a swarup. Mukti hitvanya tarupam swarupena vyavyastuti seisibhadam. So even to be situated as Atmas, without even having a siddha deha, if you will, so for us, our bhakti swarup is the most possible highest reach we can have as Atmas. So bhakti is not inherent, but our brightest potential can be met with bhakti. But you can achieve some other level of attainment for eternity, which doesn't imply prem, as we were speaking yesterday. You can attain Vaikuntha without prem. Rupa Goswami mentions that the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. You can attain Santarasa in Vaikuntha for eternity. Santarasa does not imply prem. One of the main symptoms of prem is mamata, which is possessiveness. towards Krishna. The main symptom of Santa Rasa is nirmamata, lack of possessiveness. Or you can attain Brahma Sayuja. You can go to Brahman for eternity. That doesn't require prem. So the point is, you can attain a position in eternity, and it doesn't mean that you have to have prem. So the fact that you can have prem and recite, that speaks about a special upgrading of our potential that happens only in connection with bhakti. Yeah. Read my book. That's the homework this time. As much as you will have time to that, I'm sure that you are pretty busy as well.
Does your book say what the essential ontology of the jiva is, like void of bhakti? Like,
I hope, yes. So you let, read my book. I mean, you are reading it, but keep doing it. Yeah. We continue these days for the Q&As, or if someone cannot have for Q&A or has some question, you can contact me personally. Somehow we can continue speaking, no problem. So thank you so much for your time, for your questions, for your presence, and we keep, tomorrow we have, for those who would like to come, the Tirubhav Mahotsav in the morning of Vrindavan Das Thakur, so we will be meeting at 8 in the morning. Okay. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda ki jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanam Hari.